And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
No one can prove that global warming is behind what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere right now, but there's no doubt about it. It's hot. And the heat may be the cause for increasing heat amongst the humans on this planet, as things generally keep getting hotter and hotter. Today, we deliver a special State of the Planet report, and then visit the world-famous San Diego Zoo, which just opened its most ambitious new exhibit, called Monkey Walk. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues, following this short break here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's a good chance that as you listen to today's show, you're one of the millions around the world who are saying, it's hot, it's really hot. It is hot. Here in San Diego, along the coast, I'm actually uncomfortable, perhaps for the first time in the over 6 years I've lived here. And when I hear my friends in other parts of the country, well, a bit north of San Diego, today the nation's record temperature was set by Bakersfield, California, which reached 128 degrees. And when I hear that it's in the 90s in New Hampshire and Washington State, with their mega humidities and generally in the 90s in almost every crevasse of the U.S., it may just be that all this talk of the Earth slowly warming is a bag of hooey. It's warming up really fast. But then no one can prove this is anything but a warm spell. But the temperatures are hot everywhere. Europe has got the same thing going on. The Greeks are experiencing their own slow roasting as they suffer through 90-plus degree temperatures. They are concerned about a general failure of their electric grid. So today, since it's pretty miserable no matter where you are, I thought it appropriate to just go ahead and give us my version of a State of the World report. That will happen in our first segment, and then in segments 2 and 3, we visit the newest and most elaborate exhibit at the San Diego Zoo. 4 years in the making, Monkey Trails is a significant advance in animal exhibition, making some pretty bold attempts at recreating a living environment for the animals in a zoo setting. That's coming up. So now, an expanded news as the Wild Side News brings you its latest State of the World report. Today, the sun rises at 5.06 a.m. and sets at 7.06 p.m. Today is exactly 14 hours long. According to the mainstream media, this is what's happening in the world today. Hurricane Emily has landed along areas of the Gulf Coast. Set at a Force 3 storm, Emily is whipping everything in its path with 125-plus winds. People in low-lying areas are fleeing for safety and boarding up their homes and businesses. Meanwhile, the storm is setting off another round of anxiety in the oil markets as they watch to see the effects the storm will have on Gulf oil production, which provides 30% of U.S. oil. The one positive story coming from that part of the world is that the previous storm, Hurricane Dennis, that invaded the Gulf's coastal waters, actually helped to fix an ailing artificial reef. The Spiegel Grove was intentionally sunk in 2002 to create an artificial underwater reef, but things did not go so well for the project. As the boat sank, it turned upside down and got stuck in that position, with part of the bow sticking up above the waters. Attempts to properly sink the boat managed to get the 512-foot vessel on its side, but it wasn't until last week's Hurricane Dennis that the force of the hurricane flipped the ship one more time, this time getting it upright, at which point it sank to the bottom, where it is now quickly becoming the home to millions of sea urchins, fish, and a whole new ecosystem. All across the United States and throughout Europe as well, a full-fledged heat wave is setting records, with the entire U.S. suffering 80, 90, and 100-plus temperatures, fears are mounting, the summer of blackouts may be brewing. And of course, there are some who may be wondering if this may not actually be another indication of global warming. The heat is spawning hundreds of wildfires in many of the western states. California, New Mexico, and Arizona, as usual, are being particularly hard hit. Meanwhile, in the nation's capital, the president announced his nomination to fill the vacancy created by the resignation of Sandra Day O'Connor, Judge John Roberts. And Scott McClellan continued to refuse to answer any questions concerning whether Karl Rove was the source for the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity as a CIA operative in retaliation for her husband's writing an article in which he challenged the validity of the claim that Saddam Hussein was secretly buying uranium from Algeria. And in Iraq, the story gets more complex as the president of Iraq signed a mutual defense treaty with Iran as suicide bombings accelerate. In London, investigations continue as four Palestinian young men are identified as suicide bombers. Back in the nation's capital, the lacrosse team have created quite a flip-flap when they wore flip-flops to a White House photo op with the president. Meanwhile, as the fight over evolution continues to evolve in the nation's schools, evolution in reality just keeps on evolving. Let me explain. In a most bizarre example of how natural selection can change the genetic makeup of a population, Asian elephants in China, prized and therefore poached for their massive ivory tusks, are being born increasingly with no tusks at all, as males with smaller or no tusks are more likely to survive than males with large tusks. Tusk size is genetically determined, so through time, the smaller tusk or no tusk animals are increasing their place in the overall population. It's truly amazing to see how quickly such a genetic change can occur in an animal population. Similar changes in elephant tusk development are being reported in Africa and India. And again in China, people there take their environmental challenges very seriously. As a matter of fact, public protest against environmental polluters is increasing with the increasing number of serious demonstrations occurring in China. In Xinjiang, which lies 180 miles south of Shanghai, angry residents are conducting a very serious public protest demanding that a chemical plant be closed. Following an explosion that killed one worker, complaints about serious health problems, and reports that farmers can no longer grow crops, residents are clashing with hundreds of Chinese officers. Last year, China reported 74,000 mass protests in China, up from 10,000 a decade ago. As China moves into the global marketplace, the rapid expansion of the industrial sector is hitting many Chinese communities hard. And the Chinese, unlike their American environmental activists, are not content to settle these matters with lawyers. The incidence of rioting against government authority is being assisted by cell phones and the internet. When authorities posted an announcement that the chemical plant would resume production at the plant the next day and warned that an explosion could take place at the plant if certain processes begun a week ago were not completed, villagers refused to return, demanded a security deposit of $2 million. Each day, the villages massed by the thousands outside the factory gates, destroying guard stations and pelting the windows and walls with rocks. The factory remains closed. Word is spreading in China amongst citizens affected by chemical and pharmaceutical plant pollution. A similar uprising occurred in Dongyang, about 50 miles from Xinjiang, this last spring, in which over 10,000 residents effectively routed police in a riot over pollution. That's 10,000 residents. Although word of such incidents is effectively quashed by the Chinese media, word is spreading that determined citizens acting in mass can force authorities to take notice, even in China. As one young 20-year-old man stated, "As for the Dongyang riot, everyone knows about it. Six policemen were killed and the chief had the tendons in his arms and legs severed. Perhaps they went too far, but we must be treated as human beings. Meanwhile, in the Gaza Strip, a complex standoff between Israeli troops and Israeli nationals is creating yet another piece of evidence that the planet is getting ever more complex. Old beliefs and dynamics are eroding. Power is shifting. Old power is being challenged by the driving force of diversity, of people standing against power and willing to stand as people against traditional and historical power. What has this got to do with nature? My guess is more than we can say. Except to say that people, animals, ecosystems, and communities of all sorts are beginning to crack under the strain of this globalizing economic model of social control. So much of what is going wrong with the planet is being driven by an ancient old system of power based on economics. And it just may be that that system has exceeded its power to control this planet. What is the answer? It lies way beyond the few minutes remaining in this segment, and in truth, it lies beyond even the grasp of almost anyone to comprehend. But it is just a matter of time before the gilded god of greed and greenbacks and gold gives way to a human and living-centered new system of society, or it does not. Long ago, environmental writers were trying to get us to realize limits. Limits to growth, limits to consumption, limits to resources. We are now facing the consequences of the denial of such. And the struggles will be many and diverse. Perhaps the vision of a one-world economic order may have to come about through a bottom-up approach rather than the top-down drama run by the grand global guardians. When we take a deep breath and look at what is really happening on this earth, it is a struggle of people and cultures to hold on to their beliefs and their ways. And perhaps this diversity is what the earth is really best able to accommodate. Must Muslims really love McDonald's? Should they want swapping housewives on their TV and laugh stupidly at its incomprehensibly irreverent irrelevancy? Do they, or the Chinese citizen, or the American wanting a return to true American values, have to give in to the homogenization of wonder? It is all interconnected, and the answers will take time to develop. As they do, you will hear about them here on your Voice of the Earth, the Wild Side News. And to celebrate that diversity, we turn our attention next to one of the world's most obvious and powerful expressions of love for the wild things. So we're heading to the zoo. It's a whole new world of wonder when we return here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
At times, we feel inclined to say that people seem not to pay enough attention to the wild creatures, that our technological age is cutting us off from the wonders of our natural world. Probably true, and yet, in truth, we are still fascinated by the wild creatures. This past week, I visited San Diego Zoo to visit a new exhibit they just opened, and I want to tell you, people love animals. When we return, we take a walk on the monkey trail and learn what is happening between humans and animals when they come together with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News. Reality is such a complex thing to comprehend. As I report the changes taking place that affect the natural world, the large pictures of drilling in Anwar, the melting of the ice caps, the rising oceans, the changes in elephant trunk size as a direct result of poaching, and on, it, yes, seems sometimes as if people don't really care that much about the natural world anymore. But reality is a complex thing. Living here in San Diego, I'm lucky to have a variety of world-class celebratoriums of nature. The legendary San Diego Zoo and its sister San Diego Wild Animal Park, and of course SeaWorld and the Scripps Aquarium. On any day in San Diego, 7 days a week, every day of the year, if you drive to any one of these places, you will notice one thing for sure. The parking lots are full, and I mean full. A few weeks back, I headed out to the Wild Animal Park on a Tuesday. I had to struggle to find a place to park. And this past Monday, I headed on down to the San Diego Zoo, which is associated with the beautiful Balboa Park, and it took me 20 minutes to find a place to park in the sprawling 3-acre parking lot. The place was packed on a Monday. I was on a quest to do this story about the San Diego Zoo's newest and most ambitious exhibit. It's called Monkey Trails and Forest Trails. Thanks to the generous support of the Joan B. Kroc Foundation, that is, the McDonald's fortune, after 3 years, this new exhibit has opened. It's located in the middle of the zoo and serves as a unique hub that can lead visitors off to all the other exhibits in the zoo. It was built to replace the old Monkey House exhibits, which were those caged animal exhibitions, and every attempt was made to turn this new exhibit into a much more natural-feeling experience for the visitor and, equally important, a more natural place for these caged animals to live. To be quite honest, I feel lucky to have visited the exhibit when I did, and I encourage you as well, if you're in San Diego, to be sure to take this in, because here is the really intriguing part of the experience. Having opened just over a month ago, the animals themselves are experiencing, many for the first time, real natural objects, things like living plants, grasses, flowers and shrubs, trees, sand, and in some cases, other species. The Monkey Trails exhibit features animals from Africa and Asia, most of which are rare or endangered. I talked with Kimberly Livingstone about the overall design of the exhibit.
It's a huge site. It's right in the center of the zoo. It's called Heart of the Zoo. It's phase three. We have a variety of animals here. There's different species of pigs. There's clouded leopards that are primarily nocturnal, so you can see them really well at night being active. And then we have a variety of primate species, golden-bellied mangabees, Lowest Guenons, mandrills that you see here. There's colobus monkeys, Schmitz Guenon. All these animals are native to Africa, all these primates that I just mentioned.
And how long did it take you to put this together?
It's been ongoing for, I don't know exactly, I would say at least 3 to 4 years. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, everybody's put in a lot of effort, and it's, you know, really paid off for what we're able to exhibit to the public.
So you must have some really interesting people here in the sense of being able to put these exhibits together, some real talent and knowledge in terms of many aspects of animals, their needs, behaviors, health, et cetera, to create this?
Yeah, definitely. We're working jointly with people who are in horticulture, animal behaviorists, keepers, curators, just people from all different, you know, facets. And we were working directly with the construction workers, because they needed to know, you know, which way they should do this or that or where you want something placed. And so we all work together as a team.
How much effort is it to make sure that an animal can handle this? I mean, there has to be some sort of screening process. Possibly not every animal can handle all these people gawking at them.
That's true. What we tried to do was slowly acclimate the animals to the exhibits and to the inside bedroom areas. So we gave them a few days in there, and we'd watch their behavior and see when they looked like they were comfortable and they're eating and they're relaxed. And then we gave them access into the exhibits and just watched them because, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen. Of course, we can try to predict it, but you know how that usually goes.
Yeah.
So we released them out into the exhibits and then just watched what they did out there. And if there were any problems, we'd address them right away. Or, you know, it's also a work in progress. We're adding different types of climbing structures on a regular basis, maybe more ropes or more branches, depending on, you know, how the animals are behaving or what to fill their needs inside the exhibit.
It's a terrific variety of animals and plants. One of the unique challenges to this exhibit was moving in the keystone plant that is the anchor around which the exhibit develops.
This is our large ficus tree that's about estimated to be about 75 years old that was moved. It used to be up in the front of the zoo.
Now, ficus, most people think of that little thing in the corner of their office, okay? The ficus. This is different. Talk about this. I never knew that a ficus could quite reach this spectacle.
Oh, this is a giant ficus tree. If you can imagine being alive for 75, 80 years in the zoo and, you know, being taken care of, the buttresses on it, you can see are about 10 feet across, and there's at least four of them. And I don't know, the height on it is probably 80 feet or so. But the whole concept was to be able to be down on the forest floor and then access the upper canopy of the ficus tree, and that's what the upper walkway actually goes through, the ficus tree itself. And then you can look into the exhibits and be pretty much at the canopy level, so you can view the animals from that level as well as from the lower ground level.
The natural setting cleverly incorporates some unique animal management strategies to help in keeping the animals healthy in a way that brings a unique cooperation between the animals themselves and the handlers.
Tanya's down there now, and she is working with one of the female mandrills. Okay, she's leaving now, but and there's a male and two females in here, and what we try to do, what we provide for the guests, is that we do training sessions with them right up at the wire. So if we walk down there, you could really get a good idea of what happens. And we train the animals for many reasons, but primarily it's for medical reasons and try to lessen the stress in a captive environment. So, for example, if an animal has a cut on his finger or on his foot or something like that, instead of actually immobilizing the animal to check out the wound and address it, we train them to present their hands to us, present their feet, open their mouth so we can look at their teeth, you know, listen to their heart with a stethoscope, a variety of things like that. And they do it on a willingly basis, and they do it as a for positive reward.
So you're giving them classic training with a reward system.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so here's PJ coming up now. So he's really good at doing the training, and they actually want to work for you. They present the behaviors to you. They offer the different behaviors to you. And, you know, it's fun for them, and it gives them, it's part of their enrichment that we provide for them in a captive setting. So, and also then the guests have the opportunity to ask us questions about what we're doing and why we're doing it, and they can get a really close-up view of the animal at the same time and get some information about the individuals.
Is that a new concept? I mean, it seems to me as if it is, because it seems to so often people would, you know, as you say, put the animal to sleep for a while, temporarily, and then work on it. But those are hard on animal systems.
Exactly. And so we've really been, for the past few years, we've really been concentrating on training these animals specifically for those purposes. And it's worked out great. I mean, you see that there's a lot less stress put on the animal just for minor medical procedures that we're able to do while they're awake. I mean, there's even instances where we've been able to draw blood from one of the monkeys who's presenting their arm to us and given rewards during the whole time. And it's up to them if they want to do it or not. If they don't want to work at that time, then they don't have to. So it's really up to the animal if they want to participate.
Do you work with the animal from the inside or the outside?
Both. We actually can work with them while they're on exhibit, and we can call them into their rooms that they stay in at night, and we can work with them in some chutes that we specifically designed for training sessions, and to get weights on them on a daily basis to collect urine, to collect feces, things like that.
Is that something that I could see?
Sure.
I'd love to see that, actually, kind of the back side of where you're working with for those things.
You can walk right down
there. Okay, great, great.
See it. Actually, the public can see it as well.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they can watch us working through the chutes down here, and they can also watch from the outside through the mesh.
Uh-huh.
So
this is somewhat open to the public, this facility here.
It's, everything is pretty much open to the public except the inside bedrooms where the animals can stay at night.
The new exhibit is a multi-level matrix which allows you to see various ground-dwelling animals, then walk upwards, literally through the giant ficus tree, and into the more arboreal worlds of the tree dwellers. Among the more notable residents are the clouded leopards, dwarf crocodiles, the pygmy hippopotamus, and undoubtedly, the most notable species in the exhibit, the mandrills.
Why don't you take a lead here? And
let's walk on down the driveway.
Oh, boy, I'm excited now. Never been to this past this point. Now we're going inside an exhibit here. This is exciting. Thanks.
And there's PJ over there. He's getting a drink right now, and he likes to watch other people work.
Mm-hmm.
So
you say hi to PJ?
Yeah,
now, does he vocalize at all?
Curious. Oh, yeah, he vocalizes.
Uh-huh.
And you'll know it when he does.
Yeah, I bet.
And then that's one of the other females up in the bedroom door there. Mm-hmm. And then here are the chutes that we call them into to do our training sessions.
Oh, yeah.
So the people above would be able to see that as well as the people up on the other walkway. Mm-hmm. So there, you can see that there's different compartments. And you can keep, you know, animals separated. You can keep one in one compartment while you're working with the other one. Mm-hmm. And so you can see the scale right there. So we can call them in there. We can get a weight on them. there's a channel cut in the front of the chute so they can get their arms through there and their legs.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not subjecting ourselves to risk of getting bit because they can't fit their face through there. So we can access different body parts through that area in a safe manner for both the animals and the keepers.
Do you ever come in, contact in a more kind of in a back room, you know, put them on a table, more like a vet's scenario?
No, any type of vet procedures are usually done up at the zoo's hospital.
Okay.
So this is all with the animals awake, fully awake, you know, just working for a positive reward system.
Gotcha.
So he's headed up to the bedroom doors there now, PJ. Go check it out and see what's going on.
Tell us about PJ.
PJ is the adult male mandrill. He's in the exhibit with two other females. He actually follows the girls. You would think sometimes it would be the other way around, where the girls would be following him because he's this big, beautiful, handsome animal. And it's really not that way. You'll see the girls move to come into the bedrooms, and it's PJ who will turn around and follow them inside. But he's very smart. He's a very gentle animal. He works well with the keepers. And, you know, we really enjoy him.
So playing a little hard to get maybe works pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does. I think the females, have his number.
He actually vocalized a little bit. Seemed like he was kind of like peering around the corner here and making noises. He's a beautiful animal. What an amazing creature. Red lips, yellow under the chin, and then this long nose. I was curious if perhaps he has a more developed sense of smell, but I don't know that that would be...
I'm not really sure, if I could answer that.
Yeah.
But what we always say is that PJ's rear end is just as pretty as his face.
I'll leave it at that, okay? If I start making any comments, I'll get myself into trouble. But, yeah, he's got a very, very attractive butt, okay?
Well,
very colorful.
That's what the females are looking for.
Okay, as I'm looking, I mean, he's a primarily kind of a orangish, brown animal with kind of yellow and orangish highlights, but then his back end is blues and reds and
purple.
Pinks and yellows and purples. Yeah, it's, I must say, if that doesn't work, nothing will, you know. Exactly.
And actually, if you wanted to ask Tanya about his personality.
Oh, sure.
Don't be walking away. Come here. Just give us a little bit of his. Well, as you saw earlier with him, he has a lot of personality. He's a really great monkey, but like when we are trying to feed him, he really needs a lot of attention. We do a lot of training with him a couple times a day because it calms him down. It actually feels like he feels he has a purpose when he knows what's expected of him. And he gets more, don't want to say aggressive, but he's more forceful with himself if the less we work with him. I think he gets bored is what it is. So the more we interact with him and more we ask him, we do the training with him, the less aggressive he is, the more calm he is around his girls, the more calm he is around feeding times. That is a threat behavior. That's a dominance behavior that he'll do. You'll see when he'll do it, a lot of times the girls will immediately, like, if he does it to them, they'll turn around and present their backside as a submissive gesture to him.
He's a bobbing of the head and kind of lowering the shoulders very rapidly, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes he'll have like a low grunt, a growl with it. That's definitely a threat for him. He'll also do what we call a smile or a grimace. It's usually, in his case, it's a friendly gesture. The girls do it, but very much less so.
Now, do you have actual behaviorists who are studying these animals?
We have a behavioral department, but all animal behaviors, unless there's a special program that comes in or a group that comes in, we do pretty much all the observations and on our individual animals. There are different groups that are in the zoo that do different behavioral studies on different groups that we have here of the primates, but no specific study going on currently with these guys. He'll also do this grunting noise. It's a vocalization to find out where the rest of the troop is, and the rest of the troop is supposed to vocalize back to him if they're not in visual with each other.
The mandrill enclosure was spacious. You really had to look to find them, which is certainly different for a zoo. And this spaciousness had already brought on a greater expression of monkey business. I just read an article about a panda that escaped in China. The residents chased it, thinking it was a burglar, but then realized it was a panda. And the thing they noted the most was that it moved entirely differently than any of the pandas they'd seen in captivity in their zoos. It ran and jumped, was agile and quick. There's something about freedom and the natural world that revitalizes us all. Our journey to the San Diego Zoo continues in just a moment when we return with Your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's a whole new world, at least it is for the animals at the San Diego Zoo, who are now exploring and acclimatizing to their brand new homes in the zoo's new Monkey Trails exhibit. When we return, we continue our adventure as we visit with more monkeys, crocs, and hippos as Your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. It was fascinating to watch the animals explore their new world.
As you can see, it's fairly easy to get lost in here.
Yes.
It's a maze of trails. These are the golden-bellied mangabeys. This is also an African primate species, the male right there. Mm-hmm. It's in a group inside this exhibit. It's taken us a little while to get these animals together, but now we have five that are cohabitating very well.
Mm-hmm.
And what we would do, same thing, you can see the chutes up there and the people up above can actually watch us doing the training sessions with them. And you can see some of the wire that we've had to add to some of the branches because the animals, of course, are destroying the bark on the live trees. So we need to try to get them to focus on other aspects of the exhibit. So we put in new logs and more ropes and give them different plant species to eat. And also they like the water feature over here. You'll see them playing in the water and trying to grab leaves and things out of it. So, and these are semi-terrestrial animals, so you can be down here on the floor and you can see them very well, and then every once in a while they will go up into the upper canopies and people upstairs can view them from there. But the mandrills, the same thing, they're pretty much terrestrial. You see them on the ground most of the time. But then if you switch over and look over here at the Schmidtsguenons and the Angolan colobus, they're more arboreal. Uh-huh. And so you'd be able to view them from the upper canopies at, you know, sometimes at eye level. And then we have our free-ranging peafowl.
Beautiful little creature. I used to be able to do that call, but I best not do that right now. But there you go.
So, and here's one of the Schmitz is coming over. It looks like he's interested in somebody or something. They're very curious animals.
Schmitz, that's a monkey?
Schmidtsguenon, yes, it's a monkey. They're also called red tail, as you can see. Their tail is like a nice rusty red. They're African.
These are African, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And they're also in with Angolan colobus monkeys. So that's here you have a mixed species exhibit where you, if you were in the wild, you would see these animals crossing paths every now and then. So that's what we're trying to, you know, educate people and show them that there's, you know, a whole niche to be fulfilled with multi-species.
I was lucky while on one of the higher levels to stand across from a wolf's gunion, a female, and a wonderful rambunctious baby.
So this will be another mixed species exhibit, and we have wolves guenons, which are monkeys, African monkeys, in with pygmy hippos, a male and female pygmy hippo.
Do they ever interact that you can actually witness?
I've seen the wolves guenons, you know, look at the hippos, get fairly close, and then decide the hippo is far larger than them, and they probably shouldn't mess with it.
So now we've walked up some steps here, and we're looking down, overlooking a little pond of water with some trees and starling vines growing up. But then at the same time, I can look across, and it's at, almost like at a ground level, but it's a raised ground level. Very interesting, yeah.
So there's Mom. She's on the far right side. Looks like the baby's up in the ficus tree, and then went down to harass Mom a little bit. Of course, the kid now is getting further and further away from his parents. You know, about a month ago, that wasn't the case. He was really sticking to Mom. It took him about 3 days just to feel comfortable enough to come out of the building into this new exhibit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These animals really hadn't experienced live plants like this before, mm-hmm. and the way that they were housed in the past. And so, you know, they're kind of like out in this, you know, abyss almost. They don't know how far it goes, and they couldn't actually see the other side from their bedrooms.
Well, this is heading towards middle July, so quite honestly, this is new to them as well.
Oh, yes, this is very new to them. Like I said, they had never even experienced the different textures and things that they have out here, the natural deadfall, the vines, different types of plant material, the sand that you have on the beach for the pygmy hippos, and the pygmy hippos themselves. I mean, we didn't know what was going to happen at first encounter, but the monkeys know that they were a lot smaller than a pygmy hippo, so they decided to stay away.
Yeah. Did you notice any obvious change, like in their sense of well-being? Did they seem to be a little more, for example, exploratory or curious as they were exposed to these new environments and actually just stimuli?
Oh, yeah, definitely. They're much more active. They still want to come in to the rooms at night. Just seems like, you know, for a safety aspect, they feel real comfortable in there. They know that, you know, nothing's going to happen to them in there. It's their little comfort zone. But once they're out into the exhibit, they're all over the place right now. And we're also going to add birds to this exhibit in the future, so that'll throw another aspect of animal life in here.
You know how you make the determination on which animals to mix?
You have to look at their personalities as well, you know, to see if, and also to see if, you know, this is a natural type of mixed species that you would see in the wild, mm-hmm. that they'd actually cross each other's paths. So, and then you have to look at the animal's personality, if he's aggressive or not, or, you know, what is going on with this little family unit. And here it was a male and a female and their newborn baby that was just like a month old. But they seem to be compatible with the pygmy hippos.
Very cool. Well, let's go take a look at those hippos.
Imagine what it was like for these animals as they now had the chance to explore, feel, taste, tear, and climb within this new natural exhibit. All of these textures and tastes and sensations were new to them. I watched as the baby gunion did a Spider-Man-esque romp through a shrub. It all seemed so natural, so right. A recent study of children with ADHD tracked the effects that various after-school activities had on ADHD kids. The inability to concentrate, the irritability, the anxiety and uncontrollability. And the study has announced that the best medicine for ADHD kids is a good shot of nature. Exposure to nature, that exploring, poking, climbing, open-ended gift, is consistently the best curative. Beats all the drugs and medications and medicines. Truth is, the same holds for all of us. Touch nature, and it sucks the stress levels out of you. Want to really relax? Find a place in nature you feel comfortable with, and then lie down, touch the earth, and it draws the technotoxins right out of your body. Animals are always fascinating. We wandered down around the lower side of the gunion exhibit, where they shared their space with the crocs and the pygmy hippos, who had left their sandy beach and were both doing that underwater hippo dreamlike swim. There were two of them, one about half again as big as the other. They were pygmy hippos, not much bigger than a small bear.
Now we just walked down some steps and around. We're on the back side of the exhibit, and now we're at. I can look under the water and above the water at the same time.
This is the dwarf crocodiles, and you can see one up on the beach right now, which we haven't seen that on a regular basis. They're usually in the water, so that's really neat. You can see the whole animal.
So they're becoming a little more comfortable as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They're eating well, and it looks like he's just catching some sun up there, but they're fascinating animals. And then next door to them is the pygmy hippos. You can see one in the water right now.
Yeah.
That looks like the female Francesca.
It's amazing how much water, how much they are water creatures.
Oh yeah, you know, they're not as much. They don't spend as much time in the water as the river hippos do. But you'll see them in the water throughout the day, and then up on the beach, laying in the sun and taking naps and. They're very active after, say, around 6 o'clock at night. They get really active in the evenings. And early in the morning, I see them frolicking in the water or rubbing their backs on the floor of the exhibit and inside the pool. So let's go upstairs.
Sure.
You can actually see better.
Sure. Now there's, here's two.
Yeah. That's the male on the left.
Oh, really?
And that's the female.
Now he's a little
right.
smaller, is that?
He's smaller because he's only 2 years old.
Gotcha.
And she, the female's about 13 years old.
How long can they typically stay underwater before they have to take a breath?
These guys usually see him under for about 5 maybe to 8 minutes.
Wow. Looks like they're about ready to. Oh, he's giving her a kiss.
Or but something like that.
Yeah, something.
They're communicating. Now here's the wolf going over here. So he's come down real close.
Oh, yeah, right, right. He's running around in the sand, having a good time. Yeah, exactly. Monkey. Handsome guy.
Oh, yes, very.
Uh-huh.
See, that's the Algon, the male.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see some of the scarring on his side is from the female. Just kind of, you know, every once in a while going after him. And she has tusks. They both have tusks. Mm. And same thing, we've trained the animals to open their mouths so we can trim their tusks.
Wow.
Instead of having to, you know, actually immobilize them just to trim their tusks. But, she gets assertive every now and then.
Hey, here's a question that I have never known. Can they see through the glass? Do they
see
us?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We might be a little blurry, They're underwater.
Yeah. That's interesting. Okay. Now, are they considered a mate?
Yeah, we acquired the male Algon specifically for Francesca, and hopefully, he'll come back someday and we'll have little babies.
They're going to have to learn to get along a little better. I think they can't figure out who's chasing who here.
Yeah, now he looks like he's
biting her tail.
He's biting her on the tail.
I've always loved their big round eyes, which they keep wide open with that wonderful hippo smile. The exhibit also contains an exhibit which includes one member of one of my favorite family of birds, the weaver birds. I encourage each of you to spend some time in your life looking into the wonders of the weaver birds. They are from Africa and build some of the most complex animal structures in the world. They are, in fact, magnificent works of art. Beautifully designed. Each species has its own amazing design. In many cases, it includes a large stage in front of their mansion on which they collect and place very specific treasures. Each bird determines which treasure it will collect, then gathers them, groups them, arranges them, and maintains their very specific arrangements. Not only that, but associated with these magnificent personal artistic interpretations are some of the most amazing courting behaviors of any bird species. Well, yes, the Monkey Trails exhibit at the San Diego Zoo includes nesting weaver birds, which wasted no time in beginning the evolution of their nests. I easily noted two that were already close to 2 or more feet in diameter. And while I was ogling them, on the ground was one of the most beautiful birds I've ever seen. I have a thing for metallic colors, and purple is a favorite. Here was this bird that was entirely feathered in the most shimmering metallic purple feathers. It's the amethyst starling. I only wonder if it sings as sensationally as it looks. The starling songs by our little black starlings always catch my ear. The Monkey Walk exhibit is new. They are adding some wonderful plant life, some of which gets fairly exotic.
Some large bamboo, that must be 30 feet tall.
And then, we have bamboo, and then this is our bog garden.
Oh, wow.
And this is a very special, unique garden in that these plants are they're Asian plants. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the Venus flytrap and the carnivorous plants. And that's what we have here in the garden. And you can't use this city water on these plants. It's one of the unique features is that we have to use deionized water. So it runs from our tanks over in the building all the way through over here. And that's how the bog is being taken care of on a regular basis by the horticulturist.
Now, is that because the city water, the drinking water, is not pure enough?
No, because of the chlorine that's in the city water. And so it'll actually kill the plants. Same with the fish. We have aquariums here on the other side of the hippo exhibit, and of course, the city water would actually kill fish if you didn't dechlorinate it. You'll see flies and different bugs flying around, insects through here, and they'll end up down inside the pitchers, and the top will close, and they'll be digested fairly quickly. So it's
things
really
of nightmares.
It's a really neat attraction, and the guests are very much interested in it.
Yeah, you can spend a lot of time here, and a whole variety of different sorts of carnivorous plants here on display, and quite colorful.
There was a lot of excitement and energy everywhere I went during the tour. You could feel it in the staff as well. It just seems everyone was marching to a happy drummer.
Do you have fun at this?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah?
Yeah. You only do it because you love it. It's a great job, and the animals give you a lot. Like I almost fell over laughing up there earlier because he did something outrageous. He just ran from the one end of the exhibit, jumping over, perching, and making all these big leaps just to get some food. So there's different times the animals amuse you, and it's definitely a fun job.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Now, we all hear about how zoos can be bad places for animals. Yes, indeed, they can be. But zoos are learning quickly and implementing exciting new concepts into their exhibits that make the experience better for all.
It is the third phase of the heart of the zoo. We wanted to redo the entire central area of the zoo, and we wanted to actually get rid of some old dilapidated cages that we used to house the primates and the birds in. They were built in the early 1930s, and so it was time to just get rid of all of that and go to the bioclimatic zones and the natural exhibits, and so we could show the guests, you know, that this is pretty much how you would see these animals behaving in the wild.
Do you expect to do more of this in the future?
Yeah, I think there's other projects lined up, and we'll be moving on to other parts of the zoo and taking out the old and putting in some new.
And it is important to understand that there is a lot of work that happens behind the scenes of zoos, work on breeding, health, and behavior. In some respects, that may be where zoos might uncage their work and make it more visible to the public as well, because quite honestly, people have a natural love of the wild creatures, and we too are learning, and the more we can know, the better.
Well, I want to thank you for your time, and I know you're going to go see the gorillas now, so I certainly appreciate that. We've had a wonderful conversation with Kimberly Livingstone, and I want to thank you for your time on the Wild Side News.
No problem. Thank you.
Okay.
It sometimes feels that the scientists like to keep their knowledge to themselves. It is, after all, their domain and their trade secrets. But I believe the public is hungry to know the science and facts of the wild creatures, and when they own that understanding, so much of the work to keep this living wonder alive will be spread, as it should be, amongst the diverse minds and souls that keep this whole thing going. I thank you for coming along on this adventure. We have many more ahead. So until next time, or any time in the archives, this is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again here on the Wild Side News.